Welcome back to the second portion of the seminar on de-stressing and preventing burnout for therapists. I hope you had a chance to think about, at the end of the first portion, the little assignment that I gave you about considering what your expectations were about the mental health field, about your hopes and dreams, and kind of what you were thinking of in the long run, your expectations about any job setting that you were going to be in, what you think that your company should do or be, versus what actually happened. Now, as you review those, the reason I had you do that is because a lot of times we hear, as the literature suggests, that the interpersonal cycle of burnout really is facilitated by when there's a discrepancy between what the desired outcomes are, what the desired positives are from working in the mental health field or from a setting versus what actually happened. And so what often happens is with that interpersonal cycle of burnout, there becomes this kind of negative environment and negative talk about management, about a given setting, and then this sense of inequality or unfairness that this isn't what I was looking for. This isn't why I went into the field in the first place. And then it gets to a point where the sense of unfairness and injustice is so bad that it almost seems more positive to consider not being at that setting than to stay there. In fact, the therapist himself may start to feel some exhaustion and some burnout. So it starts with those cognitive thoughts regarding injustice, the social comparison, and then eventually progresses in many cases to communication with colleagues that centers around those injustices. A lot of times when stress continues or progresses to therapist burnout, there also is a quality of ambiguity in terms of what the criteria for success are in a given setting. So while you might have a title and there might be in writing a job description, oftentimes you find that there's unrelated tasks or other things that randomly get added. Or there might be tasks that different people do from one time to another where you start wondering, is this really part of my job description? Is it for me to do? Is it for someone else to do? Or is this something that anyone in my setting does? So you have this internal perception of what is equitable, what's expected in terms of from you as a staff member, given the job title that you're in, and even expectations regarding the benefits, regarding how much verbal affirmation you may get, regarding how much other people around you notice the efforts that you're putting in, acknowledge what you're doing, regarding even things like pay. What kind of compensation would you get for your level of licensure, experience, risk? And that could be risk to your own safety, depending on the setting you're in. Risk in terms of dealing with crisis and making some difficult decisions. But over time, what happens is with the interpersonal cycle of burnout, that negative norms become the norms. So just this air of negativity becomes what people sadly get used to. That there's a sense of, well, gosh, I'm putting more in than what I'm getting out. And that the alternatives elsewhere are a lot better. In terms of burnout, there's some qualities that we see that might be signaling that you're headed towards burnout. So I want to go over what some of those could be. Number one is that sense of emotional depletion. You just feel like by the end of your day, you are worn. You have nothing left to give. Not to a job setting, not to contribute to the mental health field, not to a hurting person, even though in your heart you'd love to reach out to them. And you certainly don't have enough to give to leisure, to your family life, your home, or much less self-care. There may be an attitude of cynicism that you see rising up, where you become kind of doubtful that the world is even a good place anymore, or that people can change and learn positive pro-social skills. There may be a sense of detachment, and it's just like you just don't care the way you used to. I heard it said in some of the literature that you can't burn out unless you were on fire to begin with. And I think sometimes part of the problem issue is that we have such a great fire and passion for helping people, for making a difference in people's lives, that when the outcomes of the work we do don't seem to be fair or equitable, then we start to sometimes be at risk for losing the enthusiasm we had before. That cannot just turn to sadness and disappointment, but even to contempt and resentment. There can be a time where you're trying to, on the one hand, be empathic and helpful for a client, but on the other hand, at the same time, you're just so resentful, maybe towards a supervisor or a setting, an agency or a system that you work with. There's a feeling of being unappreciated. This may also not just come out emotionally, but in terms of physical body aches. I know in one setting I worked in, I was very crisis-oriented recently. There were numerous people, even young people, even people that, by most people's standards, started out healthy, that ended up developing a lot of physical body aches, that needed all kinds of surgeries, that were having pains, that were having to go to, you know, chiropractors and pain doctors and all kind of stuff. And it would be interesting to hear their stories about how over time, with the stress from the job, with just the emotional stress they were going through, how they were holding it in their physical body. And another thing that could be one of the side effects of burnout is a schedule that's just constantly packed out and feel like your life is just owned by somewhere else. So when we look at when we're going into the field, most graduate students have some type of idea about what's going to happen with their client load in terms of people coming in because they see that I'm helpful or that I have the techniques or now I have my license or now I have my hours. They may have some ideas about what a setting will give them in terms of either ready-made caseload of clients, but oftentimes there's not an accurate portrayal in their mind or accurate assumptions about how we're going to get to the client loads and the long-term goals. A lot of times there's the enthusiasm, as I said, to help others. Many people from graduate school have this thrill about the idea to have freedom to schedule and build their practice on their own style. But sadly, there oftentimes are great limits on creativity in a number of the mental health settings. So it's so productivity run. It's so run based on what can we bill, what can we do, how many hours can we get in, as opposed to what can we do while you're reaching out and making a difference in people's lives to help support you in the process. There's expectations that we have going into different settings about the time frame for building our caseload versus what the agency might have for how that looks like. Remember earlier I talked about what role models we've witnessed. You know, what were our professors in grad school doing? What did we see in terms of what was role modeled in practicum, internship, our mentors, other people that we admire or watch out there in the mental health or any of the helping fields? We also have some assumptions about dealing with uncontrollable variables, how that will happen. I know I had some assumptions about that people in the mental health field would be great communicators with each other, that because we knew the formulas and the techniques, renew empathy, renew Rogers process variables, and these things are ingrained over and over in us in terms of our work with our clientele, that certainly communication had to be top on the list with our colleagues. But for me, I found that to be vastly untrue over time. I found that some of the most difficult interactions have been with other colleagues in the mental health field where things have not been communicated directly, or whether there were assumptions that were just not clear and then people acted based on those assumptions. We also have the issue of the practice versus the business. And a lot of people really don't get training in the idea of what do we do to make an agency work, as opposed to just the clinical, how do I talk and do therapy and interact in a beneficial, helpful way to a client. So we're talking about not just the clinical piece, but also the administrative piece. Many of us don't go into the counseling field or the mental health field because we want to do a lot of paperwork, because we want to learn a lot about the business side of things. But the fact is, there is an administrative side to things. There is a side of doing paperwork, of doing a thorough assessment, of potential exposure to crisis work. There is a side of having to consult with other colleagues and work with interdisciplinary teams. Remember, I started today's seminar talking about the idea of that everyone to some degree experiences stress as a mental health professional. I mean, you can't possibly go into this line of work assuming that it will never affect you, especially if empathy, respect, sincerity, and positive regard are the types of things that are high on our list. So as I said before, the literature would highlight that over at least a 10-year lifespan, that people will tend to experience a stress level and even progressing possibly towards burnout. They found that in terms of clinically diagnosable depression, when you look over the lifespan of mental health professionals, there's a 60 to 90% depression rate. And I know that may be a little bit of a range there, but I wanted to be inclusive of a number of different sort of research things that I had reviewed. But that's quite a bit, that because of the work we do, the way we take on and process things, we can be clinically depressed. There may be other secondary factors in addition to our work that weigh into that. But something we have to consider is counting the cost. I think one of the factors that I found that has been difficult for most of my colleagues is when they talk to me about, is the pay worth the emotional cost to them? A lot of times they feel like they're spent and drained and giving and focusing on others around them, but the pay for the education, the time, the training, the skills, the rushing to do the crisis work, the connecting to a certain level of care, the being on call, the whatever's all involved is really not commensurate with the emotional cost a lot of times. Another issue that we have to consider when we're talking about possible progression towards burnout is what the mission of the organization is that we're working for versus a personal mission. Can they really buy into the vision? So I think of examples, even outside of the mental health field, when you talk about like a first generation person having a mission or starting up a company or a business, and then their children or their grandchildren or their extended relatives or friends down the road, that they tend to not buy into the vision or mission as strongly as that first generation does. For me, I know when I have a chance to interview someone for a potential coworker or contractual therapist at my practice, it's really important that we have some sense of similarity on our personal and professional mission. We may have different scopes of practice. We might have some differences and worldviews on some areas, but at the core, some of our philosophical approaches to things are similar, that there's a sense of partnership. There's a sense of teamwork surrounding those things. Also, we have to consider when we're talking about issues in burnout, the ratio of clinical and administrative tasks, the proportion of job, home, or personal life that's expected from a person, and how it might affect those. I've made a comparison list here that I want you to take a minute to look over between what the research would say are healthy areas or areas that tend to be paired up with people who feel at peace about working in the mental health field versus people who are headed towards stress and burnout. So those who have a strong commitment, the agencies where the employees don't have a lot of turnover but tend to be there for a while, where they're invested in the mission of the agency, where they tend to wait it out, they tend to pull together through things, they're really a team. That tends to be found in a healthy organization, a healthy mental health type of setting. In a healthy setting, you also have available staff and support. And I know it may sound funny to be like, yeah, they got to be available. How can they support you if they're not? But fact of the matter is, I've worked in different settings where there's been people who have been in supposed supervisory positions that other staff have said to me, how do I find this person? How are they accessible to me? I'm supposed to talk with him or her about A, B, and C, but they're nowhere to be found. I've left notes, I've sent emails, I left voicemails, I've given text, and it's been weeks. In healthy settings, coworker relationships, in terms of clinical professional relationships, are encouraged. Whether that's informal staff meetings, collegial support, supervision, or just interactions with other staff where we can balance out our points of view. Supportive supervision is provided. Expectations are concrete, not just in a job description, but they're not ambiguous. You know what you're getting when you work there. With a healthy agency, what's awesome is that they tend to tailor things to the different developmental level of each clinician. So while you might have, say, one intern who has minimal experience in the mental health field, that you can have other people that are able to operate on a more autonomous level. So really tailoring to where someone's coming from. There's reasonable deadlines instead of just time pressures and unrealistic expectations. Staff stay for a while. People do say in a healthy environment that there is some sense of fulfillment and purpose and meaning surrounding what they're doing at that setting. They feel like there's quite a number of the population of the clients who really do want help. They're motivated. They've either self-initiated wanting help and coming to that agency, or they've bought into the idea of some level of readiness or at least consideration of getting help. There's specific goals. There's a sense that you're allowed to develop personally and professionally, that there's allowance made in a healthy setting for separating ourselves as mental health clinicians from our clients to where just being a counselor isn't our whole identity, that we're encouraged to develop wellness in all aspects and balance in our life. And finally, in a healthy job setting, setbacks are seen as part of any relationship. There's going to be times that go well and there's going to be setbacks, but we work together, we know what the expectations are, and we're in this for the long haul. So it's important to really look at where you work and if the setting's a good fit for you. One of the common complaints that we find is a lot of times in certain settings, the numbers and the business aspect are so emphasized that counselors in those settings have difficulty actually doing the work of taking care of others because their own self-care feels like it's being taxed. They feel like they don't even have time to, if they need to, seek personal therapy. They can't balance out those issues in their life. So one of the things you may want to consider as a therapist is when you're looking at a potential job or a setting, really finding out information about what that agency or what that setting is willing to do to support your wellness. And remember, as I said earlier, that wellness is not just an outcome and behaviors, but it's also an ongoing process of developing you both personally and professionally. So what does the agency do to educate staff and supervisors on issues like impaired counselors due to having empathy, full-blown empathy, and putting themselves in their clients' narratives? What do they do to have EAP, employee assistance sessions available to the workers who are exposed to possible vicarious traumatization? What do they do to acknowledge that the field we work in is one where we're at a special risk for compassion fatigue? What do they do to sponsor wellness programs, end services, trainings, continuing ed, or just things that are somewhat unrelated to the field, like offering massages, offering discounts at a fitness clinic, offering time off for personal development? What else could an agency do to help support your whole wellness and well-being? Is offering clinical supervision. And I want to specify here, not just related to tasks and productivity. I don't find very often that the supervision is lacking on the side of holding people accountable to tasks. But what it tends to be lacking in is actually discussion of cases, actually supporting someone personally when they're going through things that can affect their work. So good agencies will encourage peer support, will be realistic about what a manageable caseload is. At a healthy agency, I think it's realistic that you could go to a supervisor or a department director and create a dialogue about what types of clientele you believe are more in your scope of practice and not as much in your scope of practice. I remember doing that with my colleagues at two different agencies I worked at, to where we divide up cases. I remember one of my colleagues at one of the agencies I used to work at said that it was so hard for her as a mother to hear cases where there was grief and death of children or things in the family. To me, that wasn't as hard as some other types of issues. So we discussed, oh, we have one here where there's all these grief and loss issues. She's like, I can't do it. It's going to really affect me. And then there were other areas that she picked up on for her to do instead. And I think having that open communication, and that respect with our colleagues makes a big difference. Now, this next one I know probably many of you will laugh at, but the literature does support that a healthy agency for mental health providers encourages and requires vacation time. I remember going to a seminar about dealing with stress as a mental health professional, and they presented to us even the literature about the fact that it is highlighted that 4 weeks at least a year is what's considered reasonable when you're working full-time actively with mental health clients. I remember when I used to work down in Cincinnati, it was not uncommon among some of my colleagues for especially the psychiatrists and certain people down there to take a full month off and have someone else for coverage for a while. Another thing that agencies can do to support wellness is to not reward workaholism. Because what's happening is then people end up feeling used, feel resentful, and that they're just a number and it's all about productivity. Which, while it's important, also needs to be put in its proper context. Agencies can also encourage creativity and diversity regarding tasks and interests. They can give away things like gym memberships. They can encourage healthy meals. They can actually encourage people to take breaks. I remember one of the places I recently worked at, we didn't even get lunches. We didn't get breaks. And if we missed them, oh well. There was no apologies. There was no whatever. And nor was there coverage for people to be able to take their break. So a healthy agency will say, hey, let me encourage you to take your break. One, that's the law, but also that is what helps mental wellness. So encouraging daily breaks, but encouraging even extended breaks at time for well care. Encouraging breaks for spiritual pursuits, whether that's just being and having space by yourself or things that develop who you are as a person. Encourage other connections. Healthy agencies aren't threatened by those things. They know their minimal foundations if they're going to keep their people in the long run. What we need to look at, and when you're looking for an ideal setting for you that would basically be anti, you know, building up of stress and burnout, is a place where there's not so much an all or nothing mentality, where there's not impossible expectations. We want to also look at a setting where people are given options and choices, where you don't feel like you get in trouble if you have to say no because your schedule's filled with something else, because you have a obligation, requirement, or preference with your family, with a hobby, or something that interferes with extra types of stuff. So one of the things is really looking at a setting that will allow for some freedoms, allow for some choices about ways to get the job done. Moving away from these absolutes of it has to be right, it has to be perfect, it has to be certain numbers. We know that this causes health problems, that it causes mental health problems. And I encourage you to really think about whatever setting you're currently working in or considering working in as a mental health professional. And imagine for a minute here, just like we tell our clients, what might happen in 1 month if I continue the pattern that I'm involved in? What will happen in 6 months? Where will I be? Am I going to be so tired and drained? Am I going to need more surgeries for health problems? And am I going to be on additional medication because I can't handle the stress and the anxiety of things that are around me? What about in a year or even several years? Remember that saying that insanity is doing the same things over and over and expecting different results? We talk with our clients about that, but a lot of times we do it too. So I encourage you, on the one hand, look at what will happen if you continue some of the pressure and stress type of stuff that you're allowing in your life as a mental health professional, in the setting you're in, or that you're welcoming, or some of the irrational expectations about being constantly available, having it all done, doing it right, taking on more things. And instead, imagine what it might be like trying new behaviors, trying things that are more balanced, if need be, about referring out to other professionals that might be better suited in terms of their scope of practice for certain issues. One of the things that I think for a lot of us is a real struggle is a sense of feeling like we just wear too many hats. There's too many roles to juggle, and there's a sense of this war between an internal desire of what I'd like to do and be versus what people are telling me I need to attend to. The literature suggests, and this is a mental health literature, that this is particularly troublesome for women and women in general in work settings, and women who are counselors in work settings. Some of the things that you will want to consider when you evaluate what you're looking for in terms of a mental health related job. Do you want a job that has more autonomy and freedom, where you're able to do more things on your own, your scheduling, your productivity, your marketing, that you know what the standards and expectations are, but you're allowed the freedom as to how you do that? Or, you know, is that something where you want more people around? Are you okay with isolation? Or do you want a constant team around you? Those are things to think about when you think of setting. Because I've been in both settings where there's tons of people around and constantly buzzing in the office, as well as settings where basically you're by yourself and you need to build up, you know, your own work with your clientele. And it's important to find out what you want in terms of that. Again, don't confuse it just because there's more people or less people at a setting, the concept of who's available or not. I found that in some of the settings where there were even more staff, that there was less availability. So it's important to really gauge those things. Look at issues of independence versus less liability. If you're at a bigger agency or company, or a place that has multiple locations, and maybe a big interdisciplinary team that things are run through, and there's various levels of protection, the liability spread. And that really can be refreshing. It can be, it can decrease your level of stress. Versus if you are working largely independently or with very few people around, you may need to take extra steps to make sure that you are doing what would be in the right scope of practice given certain type of clients and setting. You also want to consider what your beliefs are regarding flexibility versus structure, regarding financial possibilities versus financial responsibility. What I mean by that is, in theory, I have had so many people tell me, oh, that's so exciting. You know, you've done private practice. Wow, that is really where it's at. And keep in mind that while there may be some financial possibilities, there's also some responsibilities that come with that that don't necessarily come in the same way with working at a company for someone else. So it's things like that, that you have to decide which areas are your priority. Also, types of clients that can contribute to our distress and our burnout. Things like, are clients motivated and willing to come in? Are they voluntarily coming to us because they want to learn skills? Or are they someone who's being court ordered to us or mandated? Or someone who maybe a family member or a significant other has pretty much given an ultimatum to? One of the things you may also want to consider, especially if you're someone who's seasoned or has worked in the mental health field for years, what are the options that are available to you in that setting? Are there options to move up the ladder? Is there recognition for all the years of experience, the time, the creativity, the things that you know that maybe some of the newer or less experienced colleagues don't know? So there's a lot of different things to consider. What caseload means, how the caseload is gotten, and how your time is managed. Things like advertising and marketing are another area that you may want to consider. Do you feel like you are able to have confidence in your abilities enough to do what the literature would call like a 5-minute on-the-spot interaction about who you are, what you do? That's something that the literature would suggest is helpful. It's almost like a little mini marketing on the spot when you meet a new person. Or do you lack confidence in that? Now, I've had both contractual therapists that have worked for me in the past that were very good at doing marketing meetings, face-to-face, getting involved in church and community events, and passing out promotional literature and doing seminars, doing things to spark interest and reaching out for clients. And then I've had others that they weren't someone who liked to do all that face-to-face marketing, but their alternative was that they liked to send, well, we had like kind of like a form letter, a thank you for the referral, if a client would sign a release. So that way, certain referring sources would keep saying, thank you for the referral. Thank you for the referral. Oh, we got another referral from your primary care. Oh, we have another student from your school. And honestly, the more I sent those, whether or not they referred them, but just the fact that they noted, this is my doctor, this is my school, this is who, you know, and once they gave permission to do that connection, I can't tell you how many more referrals we ended up getting, because places would be like, wow, we just got 5 notes in the last month all saying thank you for the referral. This is the 5th person. There must really be something to that practice or the work that person does. You just want to make sure ethically that whatever you're doing is an accurate statement of your qualifications, that you can back it up, that you can say things like your what's on your disclosure statement, but you want to stay away from things that are predictive. One of the words you really want to stay away from is the word specializations. For example, you have people that might say, oh, I'm specialized in working with depression. But really, we know there's no depression specialist. I mean, any of us who have licenses in Ohio in the mental health field that are able to diagnose and treat depression have depression within our scope of practice. So there's really no specialization, so to speak. So we need to be careful not to give statements that are predictive, plan client fears, but that we're giving things that are presented in a professionally, scientifically acceptable, and factually accurate and informative manner, that there's no sensationalism or exaggeration, and we're telling the pros and cons. I mean, fact is, obviously, we believe in counseling and in the work we're doing, but just because we believe in it doesn't mean there's not some potential negative side effects. It can be emotionally draining for someone to come in and have to feel what they've been spending years not feeling. As someone develops skills and becomes the person that they want to be, not everybody in their life may like the new version of them. We should never promise this will guarantee ABC result. That will set you up for failure. And so these are things you want to consider. Know your local chamber of commerce. Volunteer to speak to community groups, churches, businesses, or organizations. Even on a free basis, just do little mini seminars. Network with other people in the field. Especially on a multicultural level, know who is within your locale. Who are the types of people in the area in which you practice that may be looking for services? Avoid subjective descriptions of personality in clinical language that people may not understand exactly. Have colleagues review what you might be sending out. Now let's look at some areas that we can control, because I think sometimes when we're feeling stressed and we're feeling like we're prone to burnout, we feel like there's very little we can control. But in fact, there's more choices than we realize. One, the setting that we're in. As we learn that the goals and the mission of the agency we're working for may or may not match up well with our personal goals, we can start to realize that maybe a different setting's better. We can look at those types of things of what, when we hoped and dreamed about what would happen in the long run in terms of our work in the mental health field, how much certain settings bring us closer or take us farther away from that. If you're someone who needs a fair deal of appreciation and affirmation for your efforts, is that something you're going to get at a certain setting? Now, another area that we can look at is scheduling. One of the things that can be a stressor is how things are scheduled. For example, I remember even when I worked a few years at a community mental health, even though typically the secretaries schedule for people, since my productivity was through the roof, and I had been used to, in the past, doing my scheduling, managing things, getting a hold of people, the director allowed me to be the only person at that agency who basically did her own scheduling. And so I knew how to block time out for tasks. These certain days and times I'm going to allow for diagnostic assessment sessions for new clients. These certain times are going to be follow-up counseling for existing clients. And then I also knew if for some reason someone didn't show up for initial appointment or whatever, how to use those time for follow-up phone calls, for collateral discussions, for other things that would contribute to productivity. One of the things I would suggest is looking at how you can have some control over your schedule of what works for you. So for example, let's say there's certain types of clients that really stress you out. Maybe it's a personality disorder type of client. Maybe it's behavior problem kids. Maybe it's mandated people who don't want to be there but have been put in your schedule. What can you do to arrange those at times where it might be better for you? If you're an early morning person, it might be better to, for lack of a better way of saying it, get those tougher clients or the clients that really try you out of the way when you have that first cup of coffee in the morning and just get in the door. If you're an afternoon, evening, or night owl, maybe having certain clients in the evening is better. Adjusting our schedule also can help manage stress, because there may be certain types of clients that you don't want to have too many of them in a row. That's why I've always wanted to manage my own schedule. Even when there was a secretary, I've always taken care of my own, because, say, you might not want 6 or 8 depressed people in a row. After 3 or 4, you might think, wow, everybody's just very monotone, they're having low motivation, they're whatever, I need something a little different in there. So there are ways to block your schedule, to reschedule. One way you can do an exercise to address this is maybe to put examples of hypothetical client situations on cards. So let's say you have rebellious teenager with behavior problem issues and truancy on card number one. You have personality disordered, resistant, court-ordered person on card number two. You have cooperative, nice, old lady with life adjustment issues who, quote, just wants someone to talk to. And so on. You can take and kind of reorder these just like you might in your schedule to really look at, when you look at the totality of the case, what times of day might be better for me to see clients? Are there certain days of the week or certain times that are better? For example, I remember when I was around 30 years old, there was myself and four other people at the building that I did my mental health work at that time, and we all had our own practices. The thing was, we would love to just pile on the clients. We would be there from 9-10 in the morning till 10-11 at night in the building, and it was like we would just see the clients back to back to back to back, you know, and we're like, wow, if we can get them in 3 days, 4 days a week and just do 12 to 16 hours a day, you know, we would do that. But I found that there were some other ladies in the same building with their own practice who sometimes only saw 2 to 4 or maybe 5 clients a day and were there almost every day of the week. So it's really about self-evaluating and finding out what works for you. Another area that we can control and we can adjust and modify is development of a treatment plan and developing of our counseling goals. That's what the whole diagnostic assessment piece is all about, is finding treatment goals that are effective, that are useful, that the client can buy into, that we feel okay about. But they need to be things that are not just general and ambiguous. They need to be things that are specific, that are measurable, that we can actually see, oh, can this person do this? Are they achievable? Does this client have the skills to be able to do this? Do I have the ability to really do what I'm promising the client as well? Are these tasks and goals really broken down into manageable, realistic parts? Are they evidence-based? Are they tailored to the specific client? One way I measure this is what I call a camera check. If there was an imaginary video camera there, what behaviors would it see happening? I find out that a lot of times that when there's struggles with clients, either there something has changed from the initial treatment goals, and maybe we're not really aware of it, or we haven't been very clear about it, or the client hasn't been clear. Maybe there's additional goals. Maybe what they came in for is just not the same thing anymore, and we really need to evaluate. Most of the time, when I've gone back to the treatment planning and reviewed that, that has largely helped moving beyond some impasses and some stress points. We really want to also keep a mindset that problems and presenting concerns, both for us and for our clients, in real life are rarely as simple as just a formula like, if we do A, B, C, then such and such will happen. Because really, in real life, there's so many interactional variables occurring at the same time. Any given person just has a portion of the information, and we don't always know all the important variables. So it's really important to give ourselves sometimes the benefit of the doubt rather than jumping to the worst conclusions that I'm not cut out for the field because this isn't working out. this client didn't come back. It definitely has to be me. There's a lot of things that could be going on. And again, sometimes the most important variables are not always revealed. The timing of decisions is also as important as the, quote, rightness or wrongness of decisions. So sometimes we might be teaching a good technique or something that's useful for a client, but it's just not the right timing. That's why I always think it's good to use Prochaska's stages of change. Don't assume just because a client is calling you for an appointment that means they're ready to be confronted, to be challenged, to learn skills off the bat. Fact is, the literature would suggest that a large portion of people who even initiate scheduling, for mental health reasons with us, that they're not necessarily at a place of readiness. They're still just trying to process through all the feelings and stresses and confusion about the issue to see if they want to consider maybe making a change. So there's a lot of things to consider, but the number one thing is that goals can be corrected and modified. Let's look at an example here. Remember I said that goals should be specific, measurable, achievable, concrete, and to use that idea of the camera check. So let's take a few examples here. And the examples I'm going to give you are things that I would consider poor goals. They're just not useful. And let's see if we can come up with alternatives to those not so good goals. So goal number one, to improve the client's sense of self-confidence. What's wrong with that? Sounds good at first glance. This person maybe has social anxiety. Maybe they're ambivalent about a situation. Maybe they have body image issues or feel uncomfortable. What's tricky about that goal of improving clients' sense of self-confidence is that it really doesn't look at how we're going to measure that. I can't see inside a person to be able to say, oh, he or she is feeling on a scale of 1 to 10 really confident today. Or, gosh, they're not feeling too confident. And what might constitute for me confidence may not be the same thing for them. So what might be more useful is talking with them about if there has been a time where they felt that they were more confident, what happened then? What was going on? And maybe looking at some behaviors that could be reinstituted or done more frequently to help them get back to a place of confidence. Let's look at another not so good goal. To help the client have greater self-satisfaction. Again, very subjective. What does that mean? Are they just giving in to other people and saying yes when they mean no? Are they doing things that aren't congruent with their values and their beliefs? Are there goals they have in life that maybe they aren't reaching and they're feeling like they failed or that they're not getting close to what they're hoping for? So an improved goal would look at how we would measure satisfaction. Again, sometimes we really have to break down these global goals into something that's very small and realistic. What about the third one? To improve communication skills. Again, first glance sounds wonderful. And these are often what our clients are coming in to us. When I say, have you been to counseling before? What did you like or not like? What goals? And they might say, I want to improve communication. Things are awful between my spouse and I. We fight. We can't solve problems. Or between me and my child, it doesn't go well. They don't do what they're told. There's no respect. So operational definitions are key. It is hard to actually pursue concrete goals and do cognitive behavioral treatment if we don't identify what the desired new behaviors are going to be. So healthy communication, is that just improving the frequency of actually crossing paths and talking to each other? Are we improving the type of communication where they will raise their voices less and they will learn to talk in indoor tones of voice and hear each other out for at least a half hour a day? You hear how it's becoming more specific. What does that constitute? Let's look at another type of goal that isn't too ideal. For a parent and child to fight less. I want to know what fight means. Are they yelling? Do they feel like their differences of opinion are fighting? Are they physically beating each other up? Are they cussing each other out? What is that? And if the goal is to fight less, so it's like, okay, is there a certain type of fighting that they're assuming is okay? Because there may be assumptions and beliefs in certain families that, well, yeah, we can yell at each other, but we end up loving each other in the long run. We can do this, but we still have to respect each other. So it's important to find out what that means. What would the alternative be? Even when we're using goals like to respect each other more, what does that mean? Or sometimes parents will say to have a good attitude. You know, what is that? Another one that's a poor choice for a goal would be to feel less depressed. How many times do we hear this from our clients? I want to be less depressed. I want to get rid of my anxiety. I want to not feel stressed anymore. So again, being more operational in these definitions. Now, I want to look at the issue of resistance as we continue. When I was learning about resistance in grad school and in my post-grad when we would teach the graduate students at University of Cincinnati, at that time, we were trained that resistance was basically a bad thing. It was something that could hinder the counseling process. And there were a lot of different types of resistance and categories. Things like a client being too quiet and not talking, not participating in a session, not following through on homework, or intellectualizing things. We also might see something about a client discounting, like, yeah, you say this, but blah, blah, blah. Blame, intimidation, over-focusing on the positives, or the negatives, or waiting to share big issues at the very last minute. There's a lot of different things that could be seen in terms of resistance. But one of the things I'd encourage you to think in terms of changing the traditional way we thought about resistance as a bad thing is to remember that if we're really doing therapy well, if our timing is really going with the flow of what's best for the client, if we're using therapeutically effective strategies, if we're high in Rogers process variables, and our goals are clear, over time, it's only natural that we should also see in the counseling session some of the dynamics and the resistance, as well as some of the defense mechanisms that this client may use outside of therapy in their day-to-day interactions on their job, with their significant others, within their own mindsets, out in public. So keep in mind that resistance doesn't mean they're personally against you. Sometimes we make the same errors, the same thought errors and behavior choices that are not healthy, just like our clients do. We can personalize things that are not personal. Oftentimes, what we see in the counseling office over time, even the negative things, are things that happen in this person's day-to-day life. Things like defense mechanisms. Again, there was a day and age where these were considered like the real red flags. That, oh no, if this person's in denial about their problem, if they're blaming their problem on other people, if they're over-identifying with something or intellectualizing it, if they're projecting or rationalizing or any of the other defense mechanisms, then there must really be a problem. They're resistant. And, you know, that became a phrase back in the day. They're resistant. Oh, I don't want a resistant client. I've actually come, I'm not saying to be super enthused about resistant clients, but even today I had one I thought, oh, brother. But do you know what? Sometimes there's two different ways a client can go. If they're not going to, you know, work through stuff because of their readiness and their calmness and whatever, sometimes it's a good idea to roll with the resistance. I had someone who had told me in her first diagnostic session that she had been to a variety of different doctors, counselors, hospitals, different mental health settings, and how much she didn't like so many of them. And then she said, well, I guess I really didn't give it a try. You know, I terminated this one early. I did this, whatever. Oh, I got irritated. Maybe I could have done more. First two or three sessions went fairly smooth. But again, this is early on in terms of the therapeutic relationship. And then about the fourth session, she starts to have this real emotional outburst in response to just things that were in line with the treatment plan and some skills, and becoming very, very defensive, you know, about her marijuana use is not contributing to her stress or depression. There's no problem with it. There's no need to talk about it. That it doesn't matter how often she uses or doesn't use. That the depression's a separate issue. And that, and starts spouting off statistics and, you know, comparing this expert to that expert and who's right and who's wrong, and just, you know, really animated tone. And I think, wow, what in the world just happened? This girl just really changed in the session here. Now, years ago, that probably would have scared me. That probably would have made me feel ineffective, question my competency as a therapist. But you know, when that happened recently, I started to feel, oh wow, this is good. It doesn't feel good, but here we go. Now we're starting to hit home with the types of things where there's a little bit of a comfort level, and she's manifesting with me as a therapist some of the similar things in a little different way to the previous therapist, to people in her life. And at first, she became threatening. Oh, I'm not coming back if you don't talk about this and do this and I want whatever. And by the end of the session, 20 minutes later, she said, you know what? I've had a lot of people in my life that have told me that I'm moody, that I act like a witch, that I go off on people, that I whatever. Of course, I had said none of those things to her. But she's like, you know, I'm sorry for the way I acted, but my beliefs are very, very strong about these certain things, and I do become very defensive. So keep in mind, when our clients act certain ways, the resistance, the defense mechanisms, those are things that are habitual. They've taken time to develop, and they're going to take time to change. They're outside of their awareness initially, and they wouldn't keep doing it if it wasn't beneficial for them. Just like we don't keep doing things if it doesn't feel beneficial for us. So early on, our best bet is to just build clinical relationship with them. To identify in our mind, it might not even be openly with the client, what the specific defenses are for that client. Like I said, the ones they use with us usually in session that eventually manifest may be similar to the ones that they're using a lot of times in their day-to-day life. We can use advanced empathy to understand and to help them understand why they keep relying on these. Then, as we progress from the relationship stage of building the therapeutic relationship, we can start to confront distortions. We can look at lack of congruency between behaviors and thoughts or beliefs and what they're actually acting out. And then finally, eventually, when there's a readiness, we can look at productive alternative actions. Again, timing is everything. And part of that is not just readiness for productive new actions, but then there's the whole piece of using strengths-based work to maintain. Because a lot of times doing a new thing in session and then outside of session are two different things. Or doing things one time outside of session and maintaining for a few days or a week or a month or long term are different things. So keep in mind, there's still frustrations of a client that we want to empathize with. So when we're talking about burnout, like I said, this second session, just to review here, that a lot of times it's based on discrepancies between expectations and outcome. Whether that's what we thought the field would be, whether it's things like pay, support, approval. But over time, there becomes negative norms and it becomes easier to look at other positive alternatives. Remember that in terms of possible burnout, a lot of times there are areas we can change. We can look at our setting. We can get more information. We can change our schedule. We can look at client goals. We can actually consider taking time off. We can balance support and leisure. We can reduce workaholism. We can reschedule things and types of clients in a way that's helpful to us. We can have a sober judgment with ourselves about what types of settings or clientele or even issues or policies in terms of an agency are actually things that we want to deal with or things that just are not on our list of things that we really want to deal with or tolerate. So I thank you for joining me for the second part of today's seminar on de-stressing and reducing burnout in the therapist. And then we'll be returning for this last part regarding more details on symptoms of burnout, factors in burnout, and the types of beliefs that burnout-prone therapists have, as well as how we can address those using many of the same types of cognitive behavioral therapy principles that we might even use with our clients.